The irony of segregating children in order to allow them to belong is absurd, right? We're going to remove the kid from their natural place of belonging because they don't belong. And so we're going to segregate kids to help them find community. And there were once, was there a discussion about, well, how can we make those places of belonging? You're removing the child who doesn't belong instead of addressing why the space is rendered that way. And what could be done to change that? That conversation was never had.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Think Inclusive. I'm Tim Villegas, and that was our amazing guest this week, Dr. Priya Lalvani. She's a professor of disability studies at Montclair State University and coordinates their inclusive education graduate programs. With a PhD in developmental psychology from CUNY and a Master's of Arts in special education from Columbia, Priya has spent 14 years working with young adults with disabilities in New York City. Her research shines a light on ableism and the segregation of students with disabilities in schools. She's published over 20 research articles and co-authored the book Undoing Ableism. We're thrilled to have you here, whether you're listening to or watching Think Inclusive, MCIE's podcast that brings you conversations with people doing the work of inclusion in the real world. In today's episode, Priya shares some powerful stories about how parents navigate the special education system and become fierce advocates for inclusive education. We'll also take a trip down memory lane exploring the history of parent advocacy in special education. Priya sheds light on the resistance parents face when pushing for inclusive education and the disparities based on a family's privilege. One of the most striking parts of our conversation is Priya's recent research on battle fatigue among parents. She explains the toll that constant advocacy takes and institutional ableism they encounter. But don't worry, we don't just admire the problem. Priya also offers practical solutions and policy recommendations to improve the system and to support inclusive education better. Now, before we get into my conversation with Priya, I wanted to tell you about our sponsor for this season, IXL. IXL is a fantastic all-in-one platform designed for K-12 education. It helps boost student achievement, empowers teachers, and tracks progress seamlessly. Imagine having a tool that simplifies what usually requires dozens of different resources. Well, that's IXL. As students practice, IXL adapts to their individual needs, ensuring they're both supported and challenged. Plus, each learner receives a personalized learning plan to effectively address any knowledge gaps. Interested in learning more? Visit IXL.com/inclusive. That's IXL.com/inclusive. All right, after a short break, we'll jump into my conversation with Dr. Priya Lalvani. Catch you on the other side. Dr. Priya Lalvani, welcome to the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thank you. So excited to be here.
Priya, I know you as a researcher, and so I'd like to start there, if that's okay. From what I know about you, you've been conducting research for over a decade with parents of children with disabilities for two decades. for decades. So you've been conducting your research with parents of children with disabilities and their experiences with IEPs. So I'd like to start there and talk to you about some of the things you found out about, like, the experience that families have with navigating this kind of system. Is there a common theme or anything that jumps out?
Sure. I'd love to talk about that. So, I have been conducting research starting from when I was a doctoral student, actually, 2 decades ago. And actually, my beginnings were, my interest was not as much in the educational experiences. This is where it's gotten to now. But I started with mothers of children with Down syndrome and their experience of the birth of their child in the context of a medical discourse, a societal discourse that devalues their children. And I was interested in how these mothers constructed their identities as mothers in the context of in the face of this barrage of negative information they were getting. So those were my beginnings, just to sort of give it a start. And then over that first decade, I got increasingly interested in parents and their educational experiences, navigating the special ed system. As I started to speak to people, I realized that if we want to understand parents of children with disabilities, this is a big part. Their navigations of their children's education is a unique part of their parenting experience. And so I became very interested in that. And so I've done a few studies with parents on that. And so you asked me, I'll give you a very, start with the very general.
And sure. Then, yeah. Yeah.
Then
yeah.
We can talk about all the nuances and specifics, but one thing that hits you is that this is a group of parents who identify as advocates. And that became clear to me very quickly in this game, that advocacy on behalf of their children, in order for their children to get specific services or certain kinds of resources, and most importantly, certain kinds of educational placements. This is a group of parents that believe that their advocacy is needed. It's not a choice, that it will be required, and that you better get tough pretty quick. So that was one overarching, this idea of parent as advocate, parent as educator. And I just want to put that very quickly for our listeners, or viewers, what have you, in a historical context, because sometimes I do hear people say, or my students say to me, you know, so this whole parent as being really, really involved, this is like a new thing in our schools. And I just want to say, I like to say, no, parent advocacy has a rich history. In fact, in the world of special ed, there is a historical context. It was, in fact, families of children with disabilities who worked alongside disabled activists in the 50s and 60s, who lobbied for their children with disabilities to have right to an access to a public education at all. Prior to that, there wasn't, right? So I'd like to start any discussion about this group of families with that grounding in a historical context of who this group is and what is the history of their advocacy. So that actually led to the passing of some landmark legislation. As we know, those efforts led to the passing of Public Law 94-142, which is now has gone through many iterations and now is IDEA. So those were some hard-won gains. But what's interesting in the research today is that it's been 50 years since that. But parents of children with disabilities continue to view themselves in exactly the same way. They continue to believe that without their advocacy in the context of special education, their children are simply not going to get the kinds of services or access to their rights. But when you look at parents of parents who are seeking inclusive education, particularly as a subset of that group, the story is different also. This is a group that reports across a number of studies, certainly including mine, but not exclusive to mine, that this is a group that experiences a great deal of institutional resistance. They talk about how their efforts to get inclusive services or placements for their children are blocked or denied. And when you look at this group disaggregating by ethnicity, by socioeconomic status, right, the story looks even more different. There is a disproportionate placement of students of color in segregated classrooms. And so the experiences of those families also, when you talk to them, look very different. And also when you disaggregate by disability type, parents who have kids with certain disability labels or classifications, and those are, among those are, I should say, intellectual disability, multiple disabilities, autism, or nonverbal, non-speaking students, children, and any child or student who needs extensive levels of support in schools. That is a group of students who find themselves disproportionately placed in self-contained or segregated placements. And the experience of those parents, to answer your question and whole story ending there, is a very unique one, is very, very interesting. So I've done the broad and come to this narrow group that I'm very interested in. Families of children with extensive support needs or certain disabilities that are associated with high-level supports and their experiences of navigating inclusive education, particularly. And I'll say one more thing. If you are asking me what is a common theme, inclusive education as parent-driven. Almost 50 years after the passing of laws that explicitly outlines a preference for students with disabilities to be learning alongside their non-disabled peers, that is codified in our federal law. 50 years after that, almost 50 years after that, pretty much all, if not most of the literature on this shows us that inclusive education continues to be parent-driven.
So we have a law that if it wasn't for parents, we wouldn't have, right? And in that law, the assumption or the spirit of IDEA is for inclusive education. Yet 50 years, nearly 50 years since the passage of that law, it seems, or there's certainly a argument to be made that the biggest advocates for inclusive education are not educators, but parents.
I think it's fair to say that. I should just correct one thing, Tim. I would be remiss to say, I wouldn't say that that we have the laws because of the efforts of parents alone. Parents did not act alone. They worked alongside disabled activists. So I think that should be honored. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But yes, that is yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That is what's interesting about this.
That is interesting. So while you were talking, I was thinking about if you take imagine a subset of parents, right? You have a group of parents who have children with disabilities, and so a smaller subset of that group are parents of children with extensive support needs, right? And then even a smaller subset of that, you have parents with extensive support needs who are advocating for inclusive education. Because when you take the whole group of parents, not everyone is as focused or as passionate, even though the law, even though the law assumes that a learner should be included in you know, general education.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Education further. It's an assumption that is made. And even though that happens, not everyone is as focused or passionate about advocating for inclusive practices. So given that that's the case, I wonder, it's really not a question. It's more of a comment.
Yeah. So I encountered this idea a lot. You know, you're saying inclusive education, this and that, but you know, a lot of parents prefer their kids to be in self-contained mm-hmm. classrooms. Yeah. I get that. I know dozens of parents, who have made that decision. I think it should be made clear. It's not the parents, or rather, how can I say this? I understand why parents make difficult choices that they make. Right? But we have to ask ourselves, in what context was that choice made? First of all, choice should be in quotation marks.
Sure.
Because it's put out there as a choice that some parents make. But a choice is only a choice when it's an informed choice. First of all. So I like to ask, And I do in my work. It turns out half the parents that I've spoken to, I just made up that number, but a great number of parents of this subgroup, particularly when they have children with intellectual disabilities or autism or and such, are not fully informed that the kinds of things that they desire for their children can actually be made available in mm-hmm. general education classrooms. Yeah. So of course they would make the choices they make if A, they don't know. And why would a parent know? We don't have our children and go to a special ed, you know, class to learn these things, right? So a parent is not obliged to know these things. An educator is obliged to know these things and to educate the parent about what is available, what is mandated by law and so forth. And what are the research benefits of inclusive education?
Right? Oh, that's a great point. That is a great point. And I don't think, you know, being a former special educator and have been in, I don't know how many IEP meetings, research about inclusive education rarely it's the top, it gets brought up rarely, unless it is by the parent and the parent is like, well, the research says, you know, that outcomes mm-hmm. are better, you know, more instructional minutes is better. And you have all of these facts yes. that are said at a meeting. And typically that is met with, thank you for that information.
Bingo. Bingo. And Tim, yes, I have been to dozens, if not hundreds of IEP meetings. I should also say to folks who are listening to me right now that I'm also a parent of a young woman now, a young lady of 22, but went through the system. She has Down syndrome and was in general education classrooms since the day she was 2.5. So, of course, I've been on the other side of that IEP table as a parent. But I've also been on the other side of that IEP table as a parent support for dozens, if not over 100 other families, and have interviewed God knows how many families. And you're right, not rarely, Tim, but never once has an educator ever corrected a parent and said, now, let me tell you actually why inclusive education would actually be a better choice for your child. But going back to your issue of parents choosing, right? So it's not even just that, Tim, that a parent, first of all, is making a choice based not on maybe all the information they have about what inclusive education even is. But second, that there's three things. The second thing is that parent might say, well, we tried it. I really wanted it. You've probably heard this sentiment 100 times. We really tried it, but it didn't work, and I want out. And I get it. I sympathize. I'm a mom, right? I get it.
Yeah.
But, is it that inclusive education didn't work? Or is it that inclusive education was never really tried? You know, putting a kid in a gen ed room and saying that you tried inclusive ed, but you didn't give them all the supports, all the access technologies, all the means to communicate, all the supports to make friendships, all the content and the curriculum modified. If you didn't do all those things and you put them in there, and then 3 months later you said, see, we tried it, and the child legitimately is saying, I'm having a terrible time here. So that's reason number two. And the third thing, and I'll talk about that a little bit more, Tim, because I'm hoping you'll ask me about my latest research, is that not only do parents not know about the benefits of inclusive education, but in fact, they are explicitly informed by their child study teams that self-contained classrooms and environments are actually better. So what parent in their right mind who doesn't know otherwise would not trust the information given by a trusted expert, supposedly expert in the field?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, Priya, that was my experience as well as an educator, is being the expert and being on teams where the recommendation, you know, is a segregated placement. And certainly, you know, I don't know if this, because your research focused on families. So, I don't know if you had a chance to talk to educators and the reasons why they felt, or the perception that a segregated placement was better. But my impression is that when educators say this, this idea, right, that it's in the best interest of the child for them to be in a disability-specific program or a special education classroom where only students with disabilities are educated, they really believe it. Like, it's not that you have all of these educators who are trying to derail a student's trajectory. They really believe that it is better, despite the evidence. But still, they believe it. Is that been your experience as well?
It's been 100%. I mean, I am a researcher that works with families, but I think it should also be noted that I'm a teacher educator. I spend all my days with teachers. I'm a professor of inclusive ed, and I work with already in service teachers. So I have access, a ready flow of access to teachers as part of my life, but I've also actually done, this was some years ago, I have a piece out on teachers' perceptions of inclusive education. And to your question, I was indeed exactly interested in what you just were talking about. And I wanted to understand, because I know And I know that the vast majority of teachers are well-meaning and great. I spend my days with them, and these are genuinely terrific people, I have to say. You know, when I think about my students, I have nothing but, like, I'm in awe of them. But when it comes down to these beliefs, so I wanted to understand, I did a study on that, and I had a sample of general education and special ed teachers, and that is exactly what I found. Every last one of them said that they were all for inclusive education. So that's interesting. Wait a minute. So that's the start of the study. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm all for. I did like a little analysis of the discourse is like all in, on board, 100%, all means all. I'm in. All kids. Okay. As the interviews unfold, now if I stopped there, and I'm a qualitative researcher, but if I was a quantitative researcher and I just had a survey and I just asked them that, the results of that study, and there are studies like that, would say 100% of teachers support inclusive education for all kids, which would have been fake data. As we like to say in the research world, that recent statistics show that 42% of all data is fake.
I did not know that.
No, that's a 42%. Joke.
42%.
Made that up, Tim. Get that.
That's hilarious.
Right? Recent research shows that 42% of all statistics are fake. So if I had stopped that study right there, the findings would legitimately have been 100% of teachers in New Jersey that were interviewed believed that inclusive education was for all kids. But I didn't stop there. I wanted to probe. And so I did. And I asked them, well, what about this? And what about that? And what about this? And what about that? And as I'm talking and as we're talking, it turns out, well, they didn't mean this kid. They didn't mean that kid. They certainly didn't mean kids with autism. For sure, they didn't mean kids with Down syndrome. Oh, they definitely didn't mean intellectual disability. Oh, by the way, they didn't mean any behavioral challenges. They also didn't mean non-speaking kids. You get the idea?
Yeah.
Genuinely believed from the goodness of what they believed that for those kids, a self-contained classroom is, of course, the most logical. So all means all, except for those that are not in the all.
Yeah. Oh, well, so I do want to get to your research, the battle fatigue research, but I think this is a really interesting little rabbit hole we're going down, because because another thing I hear is that all means all, and for those kids, right, for the other kids, for the kids with autism, intellectual disability, that inclusion for them means a segregated placement.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's just, I mean, we're just kind of playing around with words, right? But I find that argument more and more, that people are making that more and more, like, inclusion for everyone and inclusion for you means a special segregated placement, and inclusion for you means a general education classroom, and inclusion for you means, so like, the word include, it just doesn't mean anything anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. Now that's a really interesting thing you pointed out. And I do see that, but I think you're right. If we're using the word in that way, then of course we believe in everyone being included. And in fact, I'm thinking now, as you mentioned it, I was in an IEP meeting like 3 months ago with a parent, and I did say, but you've just reminded me of this. I said, but you said that her kid could get the inclusion. And they said, yes, we mean we go out in the community. We take them for walks. We take them to the parks. Anything but letting them interact with the non-disabled kids at their own school. Like, we have to go to some other park in town instead of just letting them have recess at the same
time. Oh, yeah. That's wild. That is wild. Yes. Okay. Well, there's a lot to discuss and unpack about that, but I do want to get to one of your recent research articles, and it's called Battle Fatigue, Parents into Institutionalized Ableism and the Fight for Inclusive Education. So can you talk about what led you to do this particular research? And then, well, you talk about whatever you want, but I know that, you know, in the article, you talk about barriers. So I'll just let you take it from here.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Yeah, so what led me to do the research briefly is all the things we've talked about. I've been doing interviews with families for a long time. But as I said before, I became increasingly interested in a particular subset of families, whereas before, and I've certainly done research with the full breadth of all kinds of experiences, my interest and passion actually is families of children with disabilities. But, and I had done a similar sort of research about 10 years ago about IEP experiences, not with this small subset of families. And I found the things that I had talked about earlier, where parents felt that without their advocacy, their children would not be getting the services or the placements that they had wanted for their children and so forth. But I started to think in the last couple of years, you know, time, like a decade has gone by since I did that. And, you know, people say to me, yeah, well, you know, but things are changing. And now we have this line, you know, now we have inclusive education everywhere. And, you know, things have changed in New Jersey. So I was interested, particularly because I reside in New Jersey and work in New Jersey and train New Jersey's teachers. And I don't know if folks who are listening are familiar, but New Jersey ranks particularly poorly on its record on least restrictive environment and inclusive education. In fact, I mean, as a nation, we're not doing that great, but New Jersey lags further behind than the national average. In fact, we rank number 50 out of 50 states, by the way. I'll give you a little handy statistic, which I like to keep in mind. This drawer right here.
Okay. Oh, yeah. We love statistics.
Yeah, you like
especially, statistics. Especially the fake ones.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Well,
this is not fake, though.
Okay, but this one is from the U.S. Department of Education's page and their yearly reports. But so currently we have 66-ish% of our students in inclusive education, which is defined as 80% or more of their time in a general ed classroom. So the national is about 66% of K-12 students are being educated inclusively by that definition. But in New Jersey, it's only 45. So there's a big difference between the national, which is also not very good, if you ask me.
No, it's not. It's not. Yeah.
You guys are doing a little bit better. I just looked up Maryland right before we got on it.
I should know this. I feel like it's in the upper 70s.
It's 70 right now.
It's 70. 70. Okay.
Yeah.
So lower 70s.
So, wow. I'm jealous, but okay, because we are 45. But okay, so your question about my research. So I was interested in, okay, just how far have we come as a state? I'm very invested in New Jersey and inclusive education. And so that led me to redo the whole research. I did it with my colleague, Dr. Eileen Osija. And this time we zoned in on a particular group of parents, and they were those who specifically sought inclusive or wanted inclusive education. So I wanted to remove, without any judgment, but I wanted to remove parents who themselves had asked for self-contained placement. For whatever reason, I've already said, I get it. I wanted to see what happens if a parent is only asking for what is in fact their child's entitlement, not for something that is not. They're not asking for a private school placement. They're not asking the district to do something other than what is federally required to do. That was interesting. Like if a parent simply says, this is what is the federal law, this is all I'm asking for, what happens to them? What is the story? Especially if their child has is classified under intellectual disability, has a condition like Down syndrome, or is autistic, or is nonverbal, or has extensive support needs. So those were the parents we recruited. And so I'll just give you 8 of the main findings, if I may. Okay. So the first thing that comes sweepingly across the study is that I'd like to say every parent, if not every, then all but one, but I'm going to say all parents in the study said that a general education environment was never a serious consideration for their child unless they brought it up. Okay, so let's just digest that in the context of a federal law that is already there that explicitly states that a general education environment is, in fact, the first consideration and where the discussion must begin, right? And in fact says that a child should only be removed, and I paraphrase this from directly from the law, that a student can only be removed from a quote-unquote regular classroom if education in that classroom cannot be achieved even with the use of supplementary aids and services. Mm-hmm. But so I'm juxtaposing this so that our listeners can understand this is what the law is saying. But here every parent says, never in the beginning was it suggested for their child with extensive support needs that a gen. And if it was mentioned, it was mentioned in the context of sort of a very generic general education classroom cannot be considered because it is not appropriate for your child right now. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a sweeping boom right there, right? So their initial placements, the vast majority of the parents said, even coming in at preschool, you got a 3-year-old child who we've never tried, who's never set foot in a general education classroom with their peers. We're being told this child is going to start out in a self-contained classroom. So that was one extremely broad finding. So then many parents, if not most, said that they brought up at some point inclusive education themselves. Like they had to initiate the conversation. They had to say, well, I've heard about this. Some of them didn't bring it up at first. They brought it up 4 years later. Each one had a different story, right? A great number of their children started out and had spent many years in self-contained classrooms. Parents had heard about it through the buzz. They went to a conference. They spoke to a friend. They learned about it. And they bring it up at an IEP meeting, okay? And to your earlier point, they're talking about, well, I've heard about this research and the benefits and so forth. Then the findings show that when they requested it, that's when the roadblock starts to hit. And they are told, it's great. It's great that you've heard about this stuff, but it's not for your kid. And then, some parents left it at that. Mm-hmm. Some parents asked for a reasoning because they had learned that a reason was supposed to be documented on the IEP. They were, now that's the really interesting part of the study. They were informed any number of things ranging from, this you've probably heard, the general education classroom is too loud, too big, too overwhelming, too crowded, too noisy, too fast, too academic. It's just not going to be a good idea.
Yep.
Other parents were told, so there were different categories in the paper. I sort of outlined it much better than I might be doing right now, but I've sort of laid out the different categories of reasoning. Another category was the child's characteristics. So it's either the characteristic of the general ed class. It's too loud. It's too noisy. It's too fast. I don't know why any kid goes there, quite frankly. Right? It sounds like an awful place. Nobody can learn there. But the second category was the characteristic of the child. The child isn't ready because they don't speak. They don't write. They're not potty trained. Or they're not academically able to keep up with the curriculum. They don't have certain supposedly prerequisite skills. Their behaviors, their non-speaking, make them not a candidate for the general education classroom. And so there's this idea in IDEA, if that's not a sort of funny way to say it, that this idea of burden of proof. And federal law makes it clear that burden of proof lies on a district to explain why a child is removed from a classroom. In other words, it is assumed that a child with a disability is in a general education classroom. The burden of proof, like in our legal system, right, is upon the person making the case to remove the child. The burden of proof is never on anyone to make a case for why a child should be. Yet the study shows that every of these parents said that at some point they were made to believe that they had to make a case. Some parents made recordings of their child at home. Some parents wrote elaborate narratives about what their child could do and why they thought. Other parents researched the benefits of inclusive education. I'm like, what? Like, why are we expecting parents to be doing these things, right? Another thing that was really disturbing, actually, was that some parents were told that their children will not make friends and will be teased or bullied or not fit in a general education class. This idea, you know, they're just not going to fit in there. But in this other class, it's small, it's loving. They're going to feel like they belong, and they'll find community there. It's sort of, to me, a little bit morally problematic because I'm a mom. And I'm a psychologist, and I can see how that plays right into our deepest fears as mothers of children with disabilities. Do you know what hits at the core? The idea that my child won't have friends, that my child will be teased or bullied and not belong. And that goes for that goes right to the core of the issue of your earlier question as to why some parents felt, you know what? Well, then, of course, this space is much better. The irony of the people who were saying this, I mean, I don't know how this didn't hit anyone, but the irony of segregating children in order to allow them to belong is absurd, right? We're going to remove the kid from their natural place of belonging. And we're going to, because they don't belong. And so we're going to segregate kids to help them find community. And never once was there a discussion about, well, how can we make those places of belonging? You're removing the child who doesn't belong instead of addressing why the place, the space, why the space is rendered that way, and what could be done to change that, that conversation was never had. And so you've heard of the steering practices of, I guess people talk about real estate steering practices. I've coined this concept of the steering practices of special education. Because this thing comes up a lot, not just in my research, but across the literature, where parents are told the benefits of self-contained classrooms and the general ed classroom is downplayed. So in this study, every single parent pretty much said that the bells and whistles of the self-contained classrooms were outlined to them in great detail. They were explicitly told, here, in this self-contained class, it's this beautiful haven. There's only five kids. There's all these teachers. There's so much support. You can have an individualized education here for any child. You can have materials that are correct for them. You can have a special education teacher. That classroom, remember, too loud, too fast-paced. Your kid's going to get lost.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
So it's almost like self-contained classrooms were marketed and packaged. And I use those words because parents used, I do like a discourse analysis in my studies, and I look at the words that come up, and words like sold came up a lot. So they sold it to me and I bought it. This line came up. So what did I know? They sold it to me. I was sold. I bought it. And that's why I use the language of packaging and marketing of certain spaces as better than others. So those are some of the key findings that came out. I want to make sure that listeners understand that parents are not a passive group, because it sounds from everything I'm saying is that they were like barraged by this information. And but in fact, the parents in my study pushed back, right? Most of them, if not all, at some point attempted to push back. But here is where it becomes problematic, because pushing back requires a certain level of privilege. Yes. A certain, like, who gets to push back? Which parent? And then the discrepancies in family background, circumstance, language, families of, you know, linguistically diverse families, those from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, those who simply do not have the ability to take on an institutional system, right? So pushback becomes problematic, whereas many pushed back, and some were successful, not all, in getting their children out of a self-contained space and into an inclusive one, to my earlier point about inclusive education being parent-driven. I mean, some, the last I checked, are still struggling and engaged in this so-called fight to get their children included.
This is heartbreaking, honestly. Because I... As you were giving all those reasons, specific instances came to mind of families when I was in the school system, and it just like every single every single example you gave, I thought of somebody. And let's just, I just want to bring up what you talked about, about having families having a certain amount of privilege to be even able to fight. Right. And I'm specifically thinking about, those families who speak another language than other than English, and how those steering practices, like you said, it's just so, compelling for a family who already is at a disadvantage because information is going through an interpreter, or maybe even not an interpreter at all. Maybe it's a sibling that can speak both languages, mm-hmm. right? It's just so, it's so deceptive.
Absolutely.
That the family will say, we'll just go along with it and be like, yeah, yeah. And so if there's no one else saying anything, no educator, nobody else giving another option to provide services or, you know, a placement, then it's, you know, you could have 100 IEPs like that and all of them would go to a segregated and self-contained environment.
Exactly. And for that reason, parent advocacy itself should be problematized. I invite parents to think about the ways in which our parent advocacy actually hurts the system a little bit. Because of one, what we just said, it's only certain parents who are even able to be at the table to advocate, right? The parents in my study, the kinds of things, Tim, that parents do is jaw-dropping. These parents talked about, I mean, certainly they go to conferences, they join organizations, they go to workshops to learn how to, they learn about special ed law. I had parents in my study, I will tell you, three of them, you know, joined nonprofit organizations and took leadership roles. One established a new nonprofit organization to educate others. Four parents in my study went back to grad school just to be able to be a better advocate. 22 of them hired a special ed advocate. Nine of them hired an attorney. Five of them relocated their family to a different district. So, okay, look at all these things that they're doing. That requires some level of, again, the word is privilege, to be able to do these things. You need a little bit of, first, you need time. You need energy. It's exhausting, right? And what else do I need? I need a little bit of capital to do these things. Mm-hmm. So when the parents who are able to do these things do them, and I don't fault them for doing it, but it leaves the kids of those who cannot further marginalized. Okay? So we're actually feeding into the inequalities in a way. And the bigger issue is when we deal with the situation on a case-by-case level, we leave the system unchanged. We're just fishing kids out of the water one by one. Mm-hmm. And I implicate myself in the problem of advocacy, because when we are sort of metaphorically fishing child out of the water one by one, we're not dealing with the person who's throwing them into the water, if you will, in the first place.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I saw that over and over in my study. These parents were invested in trying to get access for their child to an inclusive setting.
Priya, you use the words battle and fight in relation to, it's the title of your research, but as it relates to parents and inclusive education. And believe me, I've actually, I remember, I'm going to tell you this really quick story because I think it matters. Like as an educator, I invited a parent and a student to come speak to to educators at a particular school I was supporting. And this learner was on the autism spectrum, and he told his story about being included and then also the parent. And in that talk, they talked about fighting for inclusive education. And at the end, one of my special education supervisors came to me and said, "That was great. We really enjoyed having this student talk about his experience. But did they really have to say fight? Did they really have, it sounds so combative, and it sounds so, you know, that's not the message that we want to send." So I'll ask you, why use those words? Is there a reason for those particular words, in this discussion?
Yeah. Thanks, Tim. I also do get asked that. Several of my pieces have the word fight or battle in it. I just want to say outright, it is not my word. As a researcher, I try to bring the essence of my participants to the forefront. And not just my work, but if you do an analysis of words used in parent narratives as they are talking about their experiences with inclusive ed and or navigating special education, and I'm not the only, and actually there's a researcher, I think Miller did some actual analysis of just that. But the battle-related metaphors are extremely prolific in their stories. Across all narratives, you find words like, so we brought out the guns, we had to put on our armor, we're getting ready for battle, bring on the war paint, and parents don't want it to be a fight. They experience it as battle fatigue. They are tired. They are exhausted. They've had to take time off work. I had parents in my study who've had to take time off work, who've had to take leave in order to engage in this. They don't want to fight, but I would be remiss to put out there that this is how it is being experienced.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be that way.
Absolutely not. Especially since what they are battling for was already won in 1975.
The battle was won.
We need to send everyone home.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, okay. This has been such a fascinating and really enlightening discussion. I would like to turn to finding some solutions for our audience, because I know the people that listen to this podcast are passionately involved with advocating for inclusive education, whether they are educators, whether they are family members, or both. So what, in your perspective, are some things that we can do that are, solution oriented towards this discussion?
So, the biggest problem that I see, and I work with teachers, and we have this discussion where the teachers I work with tell me, there is gatekeeping going on, okay, mm-hmm. at that child study team level at an IEP. And as my teachers tell me, as a teacher, there's that much I can do, but this term gatekeeper has come up a lot. So I think what we need, perhaps if you're an administrator listening or a school professional, I think we need maybe a little more professional development for child study team, because a lot of it is, I'm getting at it from the teacher level. I'm a teacher educator. I'm not sure how much professional development on inclusive education, and particularly inclusive education as a civil right, is out there is being provided to child study team folks. I think that there needs to be more training about IDEA and its and what its mandates are, and this whole idea of removal of a child only being considered when all of the supplementary aids and services have been considered and exhausted. Maybe some more training on that. The other thing that I think folks need to understand, parents and educators alike, there is no readiness criteria for inclusive education. So if you're a parent who's listening, you need to know that you don't need to make a case. You don't have to demonstrate your child. Rather, I should rephrase that. Your child does not have to demonstrate readiness to be in his or her natural community of peers, right? So rather, again, we need more professional development for educators to understand that that there is no such thing, and that assessments are conducted as part of the process, right? But we also need to understand that assessments are only for the purpose of understanding the child and understanding how we can best support the child, right? That's really what it is. Like, when you think about it, what is the assessment for? It's to understand, gain an understanding of where this child is at. What's going on with this kid? How is this kid learning? What does this child? And based on the assessments, the discussion should be, so how can we support this child in a general education classroom?
Yes.
Instead, what's happening is that the assessments are being used as a tool to see whether the child can be in an inclusive setting.
Oh, yeah. Or where, yeah, or, you know, which program, which program.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Grant would be the most appropriate.
Exactly.
Let me give you an example. And I know educators out there that this will resonate. So I'm going to be careful here because I don't want, I'm really not trying to call out anybody. But I know for sure that there are educators in school systems who use rubrics to help them. Maybe rubrics isn't a good word. It's more of like a collection of assessments and data that are put together in a way so that the school team can say, okay, well, based on their, educational, psychological evaluation, based on their behavioral observation, based on all of these different criteria, that a small group would be the most appropriate. And they have some sort of tool. A school team will use some sort of tool, to help. It's supposed to be so that the team could help make a decision, as opposed to, because I remember the discussion, you know, in my previous roles was like, well, if we have a data tool that says that recommends this placement over another placement, then it's supposed to take the emotion out of the decision. I get the look on your face. Hopefully, if you're watching on YouTube, you'll see it, but it's wild because like, school teams that are already have the steering practices, like you said, right, that already have autism programs, intellectual disability programs, behavior programs, it's baked into the system. You have a meeting and you're like, okay, well, where does this kid go?
Yeah.
And if the parents have the knowledge, have the capacity, capital, right? If they bring along a lawyer, if they bring along an advocate, and they are advocating for inclusive education, maybe they get it.
Yeah.
But for everyone else, okay, autism program, behavior program,
exactly.
ID program, here you go. This is your best, your child is best served in blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And you're right. And it's framed as if it's some sort of scientific, sort of calculation. And that's right. What's even more damaging is that it's presented as if it's some kind of science that your child who is non-speaking should be in a room with other non-speaking kids. I don't know who came up with that idea.
I don't know.
And you're right. And then they're clustered by disability type. But you know what else is baked into the system, Tim? Because you use that phrase, ableism. Okay.
It's
not only baked into the system, it's baked into the law, actually. And IDEA, as progressive as it was at the time, and I must acknowledge that the law had progressive intent, had great intent, and was a landmark law that gave students what access to education they didn't have before at all. However, many disability rights folks have actually critiqued the law itself and pointed out that it was written in a way with the loopholes baked in, if you will, AKA the LRE stipulation.
Yeah.
The LRE stipulation is, in fact, the legal loophole that legitimizes state-sanctioned segregation of children with disabilities, as no other group of children in our country has state-sanctioned segregation anymore. Though we know that children are still segregated by race and socioeconomic status informally, right? But it is not a sanctioned segregation.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense? Only students with disabilities are the group remaining whose segregation is legitimized by federal law, because LRE is basically a device that is not asking whether kids can be segregated. It's asking what level of segregation is appropriate for each child, and that is problematic. And there are places that have done away with that. Italy, for example, completely did away with any such thing and rehauled their laws, I think, in the 70s and went for a fully inclusive system without any of this gradation in place. Italy has 98 to 99% fully inclusive system.
Yeah. Yes. I don't remember the guest. I'm going to have to search, but we did talk about Italy's system sometime. I don't know exactly when. I had a thought. I know what it was. So what I'm hearing you say is, you know, I've asked this question a number of times to different guests about, you know, what we need to do with the law. Like, does the law actually need to be reformed? Is it just a matter of us actually holding states accountable to follow the law? So in your view, what should happen? Is it really that we need another reauthorization to and really focus in on this LRE concept?
I mean, you're asking me, and yes, my answer is yes. It's not just my answer, but there are a number of folks who are working, you know, toward this and in this area of a radical restructuring, as Italy did, of its law. And of course, that is, you know, not an easy task.
No.
Nor do I think that's going to happen, you know, that easily or anytime soon. But the short answer is, yeah, we need a radical, and it can be done. It has been done before. First, it was radical to have the law, public law, right? 94-142, of course, we can hope. But yeah, that does need to happen. We need to get rid of a deeply ableist stipulation of separate but equal baked into our law. And of course, that can happen, as it has happened for other groups in our country.
Yeah, yeah.
Go
ahead.
You were asking about solutions, and I want to also make sure that I touch on some more practical things, not these, not just these big, but right. I think that a simple thing like policy change or policy directives at the district levels, where let's say I'm sort of envisioning, what if at IEP meetings there was a directive where a parent were made aware of what supplementary aids and services are, first of all. What is the exhaustive list of all things that can be considered in a general ed classroom? And that would have to be a discussion at an IEP meeting and signed. Something as practical as that. Something as practical as all parents being given information, clear information, not that they get the booklet, clear information about inclusive education, its benefits for all kids, the research, including for children with extensive support needs, intellectual disabilities, and so forth. And they understood that that was indeed available. As the vast majority of that group of parents that I've spoken to have said, they did not know in the beginning that it was even a consideration for their child. So those kinds of policy directives could actually make a difference.
Yeah. Well, Priya, this has been just an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for your time. Can I have you for just a couple more minutes so we can wrap up with the mystery question? Because okay, I feel like we need something light.
Okay. Yeah. I'm intrigued.
Okay. And then as I'm picking out the card, we're going to make sure to put all of the, you know, the research article links to the research and links to whatever you'd like for our listeners to engage with your other writings. I know you have a book, so we'll just put everything in the show notes, and then you can just let me know what you want, but for us to list. Okay? Okay, does that sound good?
Okay.
So okay, here we go.
You're going to pick a question? Oh my God.
These are all, I do not know the question. Okay. They've all been pre-screened to be, you know, I picked all the good ones out. So these all should be good, but okay, we can always veto any question if it is no good.
Okay.
Here we go. This is an easy one. Maybe. This says, do you have a favorite thing you do for a girls/guys night out? So basically, what do you do for fun?
Okay.
You know what it sounds like? It sounds like you need a girls night out.
I do need a girls night out. And I do sometimes have girls night out. I mean, I don't do a lot of fancy things. I just like hanging out with my friends and just hanging out and chatting and talking. And I mean, the things that I like to do, I mean, I'm going to sound like a bit of a nerd, but I like to read. In fact, we like to joke that my husband's pickup line was, do you read? So like, that's the most, like sexy thing that anyone could have said to
me. Hey, it's all good.
But I just love being with my friends, and like a fun thing that we would do is just get together and have a glass of, I guess, bottle of wine and talk.
And yeah.
Yeah. It's not that exciting, but
yeah. 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 So I recently I love that. And I recently had some friends over to watch a football game. I mean, I like sports. I like to watch it. I typically watch it by myself, but a couple of weeks ago, there was a Thursday night football game, and it was the Atlanta Falcons. I live in the Atlanta area. It was the Atlanta Falcons was on a Thursday night, and I asked my wife, I'm like, hey, do you mind if I have, you know, some friends over to watch the game? And she said, yeah, that's fine. You know? And so I texted all of my, like, I'm like, who would want to come? It's a Thursday night. Like, I'm not going to get anyone to be able to come over. I texted like 10 people, right? Figuring like only one or two would say yes. All of them said yes. All of them. And so I'm like, I'm so sorry, honey, but I have like 10 people coming over Thursday night to watch this football game. And she's like, are you kidding? Like, do we have enough food?
Just order a pizza.
So I had a bunch of guys over on Thursday night. It was a great game. The Falcons won. It was like at the very end. And, like we are all celebrating and my wife is like, in the hallway, like videotaping us, like rejoicing. And, I just, you know, I mean, not all the time, but I do enjoy getting together. It's just fun getting together with other people, you know,
That's it. I'm with you. I agree. Without the sports, I don't do, but to me, just be my, you know, my girlfriends rule, shout out to them. But to me, just spending an evening, you know, huddled with them. And a bottle of wine on the porch is like literally the best thing I can think of.
That's great. Well, I hope everyone who's listening is able to find some time with friends and enjoy each other's company. And thanks to Dr. Priya Lalvani for spending some time with us on the Think Inclusive podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was actually super fun talking to you. I was a little anxious at first, but this was great. Thank you.
That's a wrap for this episode of Think Inclusive. Now let's roll the credits. Think Inclusive is brought to you by the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education. I'm Tim Villegas, and I handle the writing, editing, design, mixing, and mastering. Our original music is by Miles Kredich, and we have additional tunes by Melody. A big shout out to our sponsor, IXL. Check them out at IXL.com/inclusive. We truly appreciate each and every one of you who tunes in. We'd love to hear how you're using these episodes. Are they part of your teaching toolkit? Are you sharing them with a school administrator? Drop me a line at tvillegas@mcie.org and let me know. That's tvillegas@mcie.org. And hey, if you are still with us this far into the episode, it probably means that you love Think Inclusive and the work that MCIE is doing. So can I ask a small favor? Help us keep the momentum going by donating at our website, mcie.org. Just click the button at the top of the site and chip in $5, $10, $20. It would mean the world to us and the children in the schools and districts we partner with. Thanks for your time and attention. And remember, inclusion always works.
From MCIE.